Hey, folks, we're doing a special episode today. This is a back to the old school 1-2 foundation, just Gabe and Sammy. Yeah. And do you want to keep your headphones on or not?
Nah.
No?
Nah.
Okay, you can take them off if you want to.
I can hear you clear. We're
great.
Good.
So, here we are.
Here we are, Gabe. Naked.
Uh-huh.
Alone.
No guests today.
Guestless.
So why is that? Because we decided that we were going to watch a movie from Netflix today from 1998. And we just we picked Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
We've done some for the studios. This one's just for you and me.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, we were texting each other back and forth, and you threw this suggestion out. And I haven't seen this movie since I think it came out back in 98, or maybe I saw it in 99. Who knows? But it's been a while, and I didn't remember it at all.
Yeah.
I think I've seen its sort of sequel.
Right.
Its unofficial sequel, Snatch, a couple more times than I've seen this.
Yeah.
So it's nice to go back to the well and see Guy Ritchie's debut, his international splash.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was fun to revisit. Yeah, I think I saw it right around this time, if not a year or two later. It had collected some indie hype, and I saw Snatch a couple of years later whenever it came out, and obviously watched that one more. It was more fan-friendly, bigger budget, bigger stars.
Well, Snatch had Benicio del Toro
in a very small role. Yeah.
Had your boy Brad Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis Farina.
Lots of people.
Sure.
Lots of guys.
It was a star-studded cast of an ensemble of great character actors.
And a blossoming Jason Statham at that point.
Yeah, he was in full bloom.
He was starting to come out of his shell.
Sure. Because after this, he went on. Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. Jonathan Statham, or Jason.
Jason Statham.
Whatever. His name starts with a J. Jason Statham. Infamous with mispronouncing people's names on the show. Statham. He went on to become a star, but this was his breakout role.
Yeah.
First time on the silver screen. And then after this, he went on to do The Transporter, The Crank Films, The Expendables.
Were there multiple Crank Films?
And now he's in Hobbs and Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
So, there should be. Hopefully there's a Crank sequel.
If Bonafide.
Not yet, who knows? Everybody can Wikipedia it. We'll just ask ourselves questions on the show that could be answered with a simple Google.
You guys probably already know the answers.
Sure, who cares? So here we are. It's Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. 2000.
1998.
Is 2 years away.
We did watch this movie.
We did. I watched it.
Yep.
And initial thoughts. For anybody that hasn't seen it, what do they need to know about this movie?
So briefly, basically the backdrop is a botched card game in London triggers four friends of, various points in their lives, career-wise, mostly petty criminals.
Young lads growing up in an anonymous neighborhood, I get maybe in London.
Right. We'll say East London.
Sure.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. So the four friends, they get mixed up in a high-stakes botched card game. They get into a mix with thugs, weed growers, hard gangsters, loan sharks, debt collectors, and they collide with each other's, paths.
I like the idea of a soft gangster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just feel like, the English, it just seems less violent to me than any U.S. stuff. Less money and less guns. I feel like I could be super tough in this underworld.
Sure.
Get away with it.
The organized crime in an empire in decline.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
That's a good way to put that. So basically, that's kind of a brief synopsis. The book goes on, just to give you a little bit of a backdrop.
You know, card games, they never seem to really work out in these movies. Why do it? Like, you watch Casino, card games, doesn't work out.
Right.
You watch Rounders, card games, doesn't work out.
Or does it, right.
With another high-stakes game.
Well, gambling's a fantastic way to lose money, Gabe.
Sure.
So, your odds of winning are less than losing, and that's just how that works.
What do you think would you rather lose your money in a card game, at the horse races, in a dog fight, or cockfighting? Which I think is the most reckless way to lose money. Or in that game that Christopher Walken and Robert De Niro play in The Deer Hunter.
Those are all very different. Let's get cockfighting and dogfighting out of there, because I hope you lose your money if you are involved in any way in either of those two things, especially dogfighting.
Sure.
But I don't know. I enjoy winning money as much as anyone else does, but I hate losing money more than I enjoy winning it.
Do you feel an addiction to gambling?
I don't.
I don't feel any rush
right
when it comes to throwing money on the table.
It's true. So, I just feel blind anger when I lose money. So to me, it never it outweighed any sort of,
Right. You go from neutral to angry.
Right. If you're living from paycheck to paycheck, winning a little bit of money is far less compelling than losing any amount of money.
Right. There's no brain orgasms from getting three cherries at the slot machine.
Right.
Got it.
It's not high stakes.
Sure.
Yeah.
And
you just lost food.
That's right. I think I get a bigger high from somebody telling me that they're going to take me to Ruth Chris Steakhouse.
Right.
They're going to take me to Atlantic City to go spend a bucket full of coins.
You're chasing highs, just do cocaine. How about that? Yeah.
Yeah. Some of that pure cocaine.
Right.
Try to get some straight from Colombia.
I do love the disclaimers they put now when they're advertising Vegas or, Charlestown slots or any of the Yonkers casinos. They're like, they give the whole bit. And then at the end, they're like, if you have a gambling addiction problem, call 1-800-GAMBLE, blah, blah, blah. It's like this little reach out line for people who are addicted to gambling. That is an addiction that I teach. Sure. I mean, fuck you. That's your problem?
Throw your money away responsibly.
Yeah, what an odd thing to be addicted to.
It's kind of like smoke cigarettes responsibly. Mm-hmm. Use this AR-15 responsibly.
Mainline heroin responsibly.
Sure, yeah.
So card games generally don't work out for anyone. That's why the house always wins. That's that saying.
I went to the Belmont horse race track.
Okay.
Yeah, love that. I only bet on the names, though.
You don't have any ethical qualms about horse racing?
Not at all.
Okay.
I mean, you got to do something with them before they become glue.
Right.
You know? So, but I wonder, I wasn't thinking about it ethically because, I went once and it was a novel thing to do. Sure. I didn't even know that there were still horse tracks out there. I thought it was something that died out in like 1892.
It's a big business,
measles,
apparently.
But it's come back.
Mm-hmm. I've never been to a horse race.
Yeah. We'll take you.
Okay.
We'll go to Belmont.
Great.
It'll be great.
Where is Belmont?
It's out in Queens somewhere.
Oh, is it? Okay,
yeah.
Cool. That's what that one is.
It's not too far away.
It's like the aqueducts.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
We might have to take a bus.
Ooh. Well, hard pass.
Maybe we take a train out to like the last stop on the 7.
Yeah. We're not just going to go to Spa Castle.
Then we'll
typhoid.
We'll hop on some city bikes or a Revel scooter.
Yeah, none of this is sounding great to me. I had a friend who was signing up for Revel scooters, and she did the responsible thing and was like, I feel like I should take lessons before I really get out there and jeopardize or endanger my life or anyone else's life. So she had the account and she went in and did not do well. So they're like, we'd like you to have you come back for another lesson. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and suspend your account. So she couldn't get on a raffle. And I think she lost the interest there. The fear struck deep.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get on one of those things.
Right?
I'm not in New York City.
Nope.
This is the murder capital for bicyclists.
Yeah.
And anybody that's not in a car.
Basically, yeah. It's a pedestrian nightmare.
Sure. These delivery trucks, man, they love killing people.
You just live in people's blind spots.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then City Hall, they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, whatever, man. We need to crack some eggs to keep this omelet of industry chugging along.
Yep. I've chosen to not trust Gen Pop with my life.
Mm-hmm.
So you're counting on the wherewithal of other people, the awareness of other human beings when you're on a bike at weird angles behind people. So not the best.
So, that's until we build some sky bridges for all the bikers around here. New York's just not going to be green, baby.
Tried.
Yeah, we tried.
Bike lanes and shit.
There's a couple.
Yeah. I get into more shit in bike lanes than I do when I'm walking because I don't really consider them lanes.
Scared of getting doors.
Oh, yeah. Two friends of mine have gotten seriously injured.
Funny when you see it on film.
Yeah.
Terrible when it happens in real life.
Yeah. not great when it happens to your friends.
That's right. So here we go, man. Guy Ritchie, he's out here. He was making commercials, and then he was making music videos.
Right.
And then this is his first feature-length film.
In 1998.
And he's trying to make that money. So he's like, well, how do I get this film made? I know. I need to get Sting in it. Sting is going to be the draw. So that was his big celebrity get.
Yeah, at that time, he was the biggest celebrity in the film.
The biggest celebrity in England, maybe. And they were like, let's throw him in this movie. But I listened to an interview with Guy Ritchie, and he said that Sting, it helped him get funding, but it wasn't actually a big draw. Like, yeah. Nobody cared that Sting was in this.
That's true.
He plays JD, the dad who owns the pub.
Right, the father of the guy that loses in the card game.
Yeah, kind of like a surly dad in this. Doesn't have a lot of lines.
He doesn't seem like a loving
or supportive dad either.
Well, if your son's a degenerate gambler fuck up, it's hard to turn the other cheek repeatedly for 20, 23 years or however old this guy is.
They could have given a backstory, though, and told us of other things that the son had lost.
Right. That's true. Speaking of backstories, you want to cover a little bit about 1998 just to give people some context?
Yeah, let's let them know all about it. It was 2 years before Y2K.
I mean, why not, right? What were people doing in 1998? Do you have any fond memories? Graduating college?
I didn't graduate. Tell me
graduating
from college.
Freshman year of college.
Sure.
Yep.
Yeah, freshman year of college.
Mm-hmm.
What was big? People were into slam poetry.
I guess so.
Yeah.
That's
Saul
true.
Williams came, slammed at my college.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah. He loved it.
He directed that movie, Slam. Was that him?
That's right. Which takes place in Washington, D.C.
Correct.
Which is a reason that I had an affinity for it.
Our shared home.
Yeah. And they had D.C. jails, D.C. streets. It was a cool movie. I think some of it was shot around Eastern Market.
Mm-hmm. That neighborhood. Kima from The Wire was in it.
Yeah.
I don't know her real name.
That's right. I think I was still wearing baggy pants, like JNCO jeans.
Wow, really?
But my college was in the woods, mm-hmm. So that lasted about a month and a half because the JNCO jeans are like sponges.
Right.
You know, they just soak up the puddles.
They sure are.
And then you're walking around wearing a wet skirt, looking like an isosceles triangle.
Internet was starting to take flight.
Yeah, people were online.
People were in chat rooms.
Netscape.
Right. Dial up.
I got my first email. My college email was my first email.
What? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, .edu.
Yeah, that was mine at Oregon.
And stupidly, I did not keep
in
all
Oregon.
Of those correspondence because at that point I was emailing people like we were writing letters.
That's what it was. Everyone just didn't know what to do.
All my emails were like Bram Stoker, Dracula, correspondence back and forth with other people.
Yeah.
Multiple paragraphs. Now my emails are like K.
Yeah.
Period. Sometimes.
It's
smiley face.
The downgrading of the English language. Everyone's just chopped up bullet points.
Or I just use whatever the auto response is on the email. Like, you got it. I'll be there.
Yeah. Sounds great. Thanks. You have an annual checkup. See you then.
Come in for the results of the tests.
A little shot of internet democracy was seen when Hank, the angry drunken dwarf from Howard Stern, was voted the most beautiful person in the world that year.
You know what? I'm into direct participation.
Right.
I'm into breaking down the hierarchies. Let's have horizontal democracy.
He edged out Leonardo DiCaprio by 215,000 votes.
Sure. Well, Leo was not – he was probably still in his ugly duckling phase.
Right.
Sure. He wasn't
– Oh, that was Titanic, Leo.
He wasn't the ugly duckling phase.
Right.
He was not in the sexy phase, that Shutter Island phase.
Right. Well, the odd thing was is you would think that, 13-year-old girls would vote in droves, but apparently the only people on the internet back then were people that listened to Howard Stern, so the dregs.
Mouth-breathing neck beards.
The dregs were out there voting.
Sure.
Big movies included Saving Private Ryan. That was a huge one that year, I think probably the biggest.
Yeah. If only that movie was just the first 10 minutes.
Right.
For 2 hours. The one nugget of wisdom I gleaned from that movie was if you need to fall asleep, just try to stay awake.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way to trick your brain because all of our brains have oppositional defiant disorder.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you say, don't think about the pink elephant.
That's what are you going to think about?
Exactly.
Right.
Don't try to fall asleep. Your brain will immediately say, it's time to take a quick 20 winks. Maybe 50 winks.
And a drop the ball news brief. Marvel offered the cinematic rights of almost all of its characters to Sony for $25 million in 98. Sony rejected the offer and only purchased the rights to Spider-Man for $10 million, which seemed like a bargain to them, believing that that's the only character that audiences would care about. They were kind of right in the sense that the Spider-Man movie, first couple of them made broke box office records, but now the Marvel Universe is dominating at the box office. It's a multi-billion dollar franchise. So
bigger GDP.
Sorry, Sony.
Than most. What is it? More money than small countries' GDP.
This is true. Yeah. You could wipe out the debt in Liberia.
Yeah.
A little quote from the movie.
With like three Iron Man movies.
And a game changer for me, Gillette launched the Mach 3 razor.
Sure.
Changed shaving.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, it took us to Mach 3. Before that, we weren't breaking the sound barrier yet.
We were just cutting our faces.
Yeah.
Dad style.
Exactly. Having to put little strips of tissue paper
right
on the cuts like Homer Simpson. And then slapping our faces with alcohol and screaming into the void.
Right.
Yeah.
Toni Morrison, who just recently passed away, a Nobel laureate.
R.I.P.
Called Bill Clinton the first black president, saying Clinton displays almost every trope of blackness. Single parent household, born poor, working class, saxophone playing, McDonald's and junk food loving boy from Arkansas.
Well, I mean, all right. I guess I'll give her a pass because she's dead. I'm not here to grave dance, but
nobody knew.
What a silly thing to say.
Yeah.
Sure.
And yeah, that's just an odd off-racist thing to say, kind of.
Yeah, it is kind of a weird. Well, you know, it's not a reverse racism thing.
It's not. She's a black weird, woman. And
yeah, it's
what
like
is
a weird. It's just. Yeah, why impose a racial characteristic on him?
Yeah.
He didn't do a lot for black people.
Do a
he
lot
loved
for
locking him up.
Didn't do a lot for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's 1998 in a bit of a nutshell. I was in Oregon freshman year. You were out in the woods in Maine.
The 90s, man.
Yeah.
Generation X's heyday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this movie is an artifact of the 90s.
It really is.
And I think it's got a lot of pop culture references in it, mm-hmm. a lot of irony.
Mm-hmm.
It's very self-aware and really and excruciatingly hip.
Yeah.
And cool. It's super self-conscious as a film.
Yeah, it's... It's like I think that he put everything into this that a high school kid would put into a mixtape.
Yeah,
like that much sort of forethought and
none of what I'm saying is like a criticism. I'm not hating on that. That just is the aesthetic of that time is like that.
Absolutely, we've all been that person.
Yeah,
at one point or another,
he knows he's cool, like you said.
Right,
and he needs to let us know.
He needs
that
to
he
let
knows.
You know that he's cool, which is all that matters. Is if other people think you're cool.
That's right.
Ultimately, right.
Yeah.
So let's dive into Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Let us do that.
First thoughts?
Well, my first thoughts are that the music is great. Let's talk about that for a second.
Music is,
you know,
incredible.
It's shot like a music video, and it's very kinetic, and it keeps you going. When I say that, it doesn't have, like, I watch like later Tony Scott movies, and they have like way too many jump cuts in them.
Mm.
This doesn't have that. It's shot like a music video in that Guy Ritchie talks about this a little bit. He says that you learn to use all of the tricks of filmmaking in music videos and also in commercials because you only have like in a commercial, you have 30 seconds to tell a story. And then in a music video, you have like, I don't know, 2 minutes to do it. And
yeah.
Most of it has to be visual because the music is not dialogue.
It's not.
So all of the exposition has to be done visually, and he's super. He's a virtuoso in this movie, showing you all of the tricks.
I don't think. Yeah, the first thing that I took away again, watching him for the first time in 20 years roughly, is how the pace in the beginning is so. I mean, I wouldn't say hectic, but it's so well crafted, and he introduces maybe 15 different characters who are all involved in the movie within a span of under 8 minutes, each one with enough backstory to make you care about the character and a specific song for each background.
Yeah.
Which is sort of incredible.
Yeah. It's a radical departure from the British Bake Off.
which or is Downton Abbey, where you just fall asleep before the opening credits are done.
I've been watching the British Bake Off at night exactly to fall asleep. That's my Xanax.
Yeah. Right.
And I usually try to watch the British Bake Off, especially after I've binged like Mindhunter or The Killing or some other serial killer documentary show. You know, that's like
you just
really
want to cleanse your palate.
Exactly. Yeah. I need to put something on with primary colors and like a lulling voice. You know, like all right, and now they're building. It's a sponge cake with a nice chocolate ganache. Will Melvin be able to pull it off? He's only got an hour left.
Right.
Like that is it's hypercolor. And it's so dreamy. And so that is the British aesthetic that I've been sort of acclimated to like the last couple of months. And then to go back to this, it is just like so fast paced. And visually, like you brought up all these characters that he brings up.
Yeah.
There are like 30 different characters in this movie. Yeah. And it's I think maybe four rival crews of guys.
Right.
Who are all competing to pull off a heist,
right?
Say, to pay off the debt,
all tied neatly in a bow towards the end, which is a credit to the writing and the pacing of this film.
And
we're talking like so the film, the budget was around £960,000.
Yeah,
And I'm guessing that a good third of that budget went to licensing music. And we're talking like Paul's Boutique level
sampling.
Money, sampling behind this film.
Yeah,
But I think it's done perfectly because it really just sets the tone for the entire film, and the music is perfect.
Yeah, and I like that you said that it helps. It helps really move people. It helps move things along, and it also helps give an attitude for these characters who are, because there's so many of them, we don't get to spend that much time with any of them.
Right,
and it feels like I remember seeing Dick Tracy, and there's a. Like the promo for Dick Tracy introduced us to all of these different criminals, and each one of them seemed interesting, but they get killed off within like a minute and a half of the film.
Right.
And this kind of has that too, where we're introduced to these almost like comic book like criminals.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
Right.
And you kind of want to know what their side adventures would have been. Or the other stories that they would have been in are.
Absolutely every character in this film, or, you know, ancillary character, whoever, could have had its own movie. Or I would watch a half-hour show.
Sure.
With almost any of them.
Yeah, yeah. Their rise to power in the moments before they're sort of ignobly killed off in this.
The crazy thing is I can't remember a single one of these characters' names. Because there's so many of them. It's like a whirlwind.
Yes.
You know who they are and you know what they're about. But you don't know really anything else.
Well, I watched Snatch last night after watching this because they're both on Netflix free to stream. And one thing I noticed in Snatch was that it felt like the 2.0 version of this, what this movie would have been with a bigger budget. Mm-hmm. Because there are two things that this film has going for it. And one is the dialogue, the snappy dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
And the other thing that it has going for it is the great sort of film work. But what it's lacking a little bit is that the caliber of actor or the recognizability of the actors.
Like, right.
They're all...
You mean as opposed to Snatch?
Exactly.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So in that's kind of a reason why I'd say like some of these characters are forgettable.
Mm-hmm.
Is like that they're not the... I don't think Guy Ritchie put as much time or the actors were... had as much. They didn't have the skill level to like inhabit their characters in the same way.
Right. I mean, frankly, I think it also comes down to budgeting. Like they just didn't have the money to really shoot in depth anyone. And you know, nobody, I don't think it was needed. I think it's so much better that this is sort of an indie production that nobody knew anyone. And it was added to the charm, I'd say overall.
I loved, some characters specifically, Barry the Baptist.
Yeah.
Yo, he reminded me of the boss in Reservoir Dogs, Joe. You know,
he's
like a big. He looked like the Thing.
He did.
You know,
look
he's like
the
a
thing,
big, bald, curmudgeonly white man.
I mean, I don't even know how you get that jawline as a human being. It looks like it was carved out of granite.
Sure.
His name was I think Donald McLean or And he the film was dedicated to him because he unfortunately passed away from cancer directly in between the film wrapping, shooting, and releasing. He was a boxer for 40 years, a British boxer.
Okay.
So just a tough guy.
Yeah.
That face looks like it could take a fucking beating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You can't fake that wear and tear.
Yeah.
And so that was one guy I really liked in this. And just the name, Barry
Short,
the Barry Baptist.
The Hatchet Harry. There's so many great criminal names in this. You know, they almost seem like comic book character names. But they're
that's
perfect.
Right.
And that's a very British thing. So the movie takes place technically in the East End of London. And that's where the term Cockney comes from, the accent and the rhyming slang that's used throughout the film. It's riddled, lousy with Cockney slang. The word Cockney comes from its use among rural Englishmen, sort of an effeminate, pejorative term for effeminate town dwellers. So
sure.
It's what the rural farmers and the laborers called city folk.
You
basically.
Live in a city. You
yeah.
paint your face. You wear skirts.
Right.
You're not a real man. You don't go out here and till the soil.
Right.
And have a plowshare.
Right.
Milk yep. cows in
you,
the morning.
You have high tea with gloves on.
Yes.
That's the kind of that's what they were going for.
Sure. But that's not what I think of when I think of the Cockney
right.
accent.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
But that's what's – because it seems way more working class.
Sure.
Right. But yeah. It's city working class versus rural
yeah.
working class.
If
so.
You work in a factory, you're not a real man.
Yeah.
Not like not like dudes out here growing
– tilling
feeding
soil.
Feeding chickens.
Right. Just slaughtering their food.
Yeah. Working in apple orchards.
It's also referred to in the Canterbury Tales as a Cockney as a child tenderly brought up.
What?
Which
soft,
I think is a great way.
Soft
yeah.
fingers and toes.
Just super soft hands.
Yeah.
Right.
Like the boy who grew up in the Vale in Game of Thrones.
Right. Oh, that kid.
Yeah. Who
yeah.
just wants to see people fly off the sky door.
Right. Just breastfed until he was 17. It's healthy. Emotionally, not that we've talked about that in our personal lives. So the backdrop is, there's, you know, these guys want out. Like, petty criminals, I guess, is the best way to put Statham and the other card shark whose name I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's okay, guys, because...
I mean, you'll figure it out. I think his name is Ed. We'll call him Ed.
Yeah, let's say Ed.
Yeah.
So they're doing little street card tricks games, just trying to, you know, lighten people's wallets in a lighthearted way.
The dialogue in this is better than the dialogue in Snatch.
Far better.
The first opening dialogue that Jason Statham has in this is fantastic. It's like the con artist who's mixing some stand-up,
yep.
being self-depreciating, you know, lots of turns of phrase.
Letting him know that he's a little smarter than you think he is.
Yeah.
The verbiage.
You know what? I was on the subway and I saw somebody, I can't believe that this happened. I thought I was in the 70s. I saw this guy get on a subway, like a 6 train, and he had a whole table, and he started doing 3-card Monte on the subway. And then there were clearly plants also on the train, and someone halfway through the like long stop between, I don't know, 86th and 125th was like I'll try, and like bet, and like won $3 or whatever off 3-card Monte. And, you, like, clearly they were all on the same team. But you're like, what rube in 2019 would fall for this scam?
Tourist?
But even, like, dude, don't tourists have the internet? Or, like, haven't they? Like, this scam has been going on since, like, 1880.
Right.
You know.
This is true.
Don't buy jewelry off the street. What are you doing? The minute that I saw the other guy, like, I'm watching this with Amber, and the minute that she sees that guy, like, buy a chain, she's like, oh, they're in this together. And I was like, obviously. Like,
right.
why doesn't everybody else in this movie, in this scene know that, though?
She'd never seen it before?
Nope.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I don't think a lot of, this is a lad's movie.
Oh, yeah.
This is a movie for dudes.
It's a guys. It's a Spike TV
yeah.
replay.
I don't see why, she liked it. She,
yeah.
But I don't think that there was any marketing to her. I don't know why she would dig through the crates to go find this film.
I'm trying to think right now if there was a single woman that wasn't a stripper in this movie.
There are three women in this movie. One of them is
three?
A stripper whose face you don't see. Another one is the old woman who is super awesome, tough as nails, in the boxing ring where the game, the high stakes card game is played.
Oh, right, right.
And he says hello to her, our boy Ed. He's like, hello. And she's like, all right there, Ed. Like, that's it.
Right.
And she's like, I don't mess around.
Yeah.
You know the rules.
She's Barry the Baptist, but a woman.
Yes. In a wig. Totally.
Right.
And,
Betty the Baptist.
And then the other woman is the one who acts like she's a couch with throw pillows on. in the stoner's weed growing lair.
Caroline.
Yeah.
Right.
And then, but she has one very important moment where she picks up the Bren gun and blasts one of the robbers away.
Yeah.
When they're trying to stick up our little posh public school boys.
I wonder what kind of weed she was smoking, man. She was basically in a semi-functional coma.
Yeah, it feels like they were smoking opium.
Seems
they're
like
it. They're selling the weed, and they're smoking that tar.
That tar, right. It's true.
They're chasing that dragon.
So the card game goes south. He's cheated by Hatchet Harry, who's basically the main... I don't even know if he's the main villain.
Yeah, I mean, he's the highest up crime boss in this film.
This is true. That's the heavy.
The final boss.
Right.
And what's interesting to me is that this is another place where the logic falls apart, because Ed is, we say that he's like a master at reading expressions. But
that's
don't
right.
you think that he would have read the expression that there's some cheating happening, or that, you know, Hatchet Harry is tapping his fingers, doing the Morse code thing.
That's right.
You know?
Tap, tap, tap.
Yeah.
Tell.
Looking nervous. What right. a tell. Huge tell.
But if you're cheating, it tells, you know, less worthwhile, or it doesn't matter. But yeah, they said that basically you can't really be great at cards. You can just be better at reading people. So that was Ed's gift. Well, apparently not that good.
Yeah, he sucked.
Yeah.
And his friends are just over at Samoan Joe's next door.
Right.
Sucking down Mai Tais, waiting for him to come back. And the film kicks into high gear when our boy Ed loses not only the $150,000 quids that he brought in, whatever pounds, who knows?
Yeah.
The monies. He loses monies, but he doubles his debt because he doubles down and Hatchet Harry actually lends him money to bet against himself, which is crazy.
A brilliant business move, though.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And now everyone's in danger because Hatchet Harry is going to collect the debt from all four of these dudes and JD, played by Sting, Ed's dad.
Who is the only person with equity or, assets.
He's got a paid-off pub.
Right.
He's got it all. No debt. Lock, stock, the whole thing.
Yeah.
I'm Barry the Baptist. I like to get men's heads wet. I'm going to drown you if you don't pay me.
So needless to say, he loses because he gets cheated.
First, I'm going to cut off your five fingers on that hand, and then your five fingers on the other hand, and then all 10 of your little pink piggy wiggies.
Right. He's just letting him know where he's at, totally. And then he's going to go after his friends, too.
Yeah.
He's like,
yeah.
You know, you're all in this together.
He's done the research.
Yes, he knows.
It's like he's looked at all their LinkedIn pages.
So needless to say, they're all fucked at this point.
It's over for them. Yeah, where are you going to make that money?
Right.
Well, the only way to make that kind of money fast is to rob another criminal. So they are listening in the walls, and they hear that their next-door neighbors are a bunch of stick-up kids who have found effete weed dealers, posh boys.
Some private school kids that are growing, in their terms, copious amounts of ganja.
But they call it public in England when you go to the private school.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
So how about that for an inversion?
Mm.
And, so these kids
yeah.
who are just like they're like the Flock of Seagull kids from Pulp Fiction that have Marcellus Wallace's
yep.
suitcase with the gold whatever in it.
Yeah.
You know, very similar characters.
True.
And they believe in karma, so they don't care too much about security. They do have a big gate on the front door, like a cage.
And a BB gun.
Yeah, exactly. But they're like, they're not very vigilant. You know, they see the best intentions in men's hearts rather than the cruel greed and avarice that guide most of us.
Yeah.
So,
So they're patsies. They're sitting ducks.
Yeah, they're soft boys.
Right.
Yeah, not hard gangsters.
Sitting on a lot of money and a ton of weed.
That good, good ganj.
Yeah.
That indoor hydroponic, bubonic, chronic.
Right.
Not that hocus pocus.
But now they are growing it for someone.
Yes, because that's always something that happens in crime films, too. And this is interesting that, you know, what I see from most of crime films is that the organized crime is organized, it's structured, it's transparent, it's just not transparent to the cops.
Right.
So when you steal some, like if you steal a key of Coke and then you try to go sell that key of Coke, the only distribution network for that drug in your town is probably the people you stole it from. Or like if exactly. you steal antiques, if you steal jewelry and then you go and you try to give it to a pawn shop, the cops, the pawn shops are snitches to the cops or they're snitches to the organized crime bosses.
Right.
So you can't really get away with stealing, robbing another criminal.
Because there's some money behind that.
Yes.
Right. And in this case, it was
our boy, Rory Breaka.
Yeah. Great character.
Wearing a Marcellus, not a Marcellus. He's
wearing the Samuel Jackson wig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Guy Ritchie says that he wasn't really influenced by Pulp Fiction. He says he's more influenced by Get Shorty. And I can see that when it comes to the dialogue. But I don't think any movie in the late 90s, especially a crime film, wasn't influenced by what...
You can see direct correlations between the two films. Exactly like what you said, between the people, you know, the two soft boy posses are almost identical in that sense. I didn't even, you know, I didn't relate those two in my head, but obviously when you pointed it out, it's very clear.
Yeah, and it's I think that, you know, there's a big difference between Guy Ritchie and Quentin Tarantino. And Guy Ritchie is like, they're both masters of making crime films, but Tarantino is a master of mimicking and stealing from lots of movie genres.
Right.
So, like, he did Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, and then he was able to move out of that and make movies like Kill Bill.
Right.
Which is like a kung fu action epic.
Right.
Or he's able to make westerns or war movies. Or, like, what's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is like an homage to Robert Altman's, like, more sprawling impressionistic films, where Guy Ritchie can't really do that. Like, anytime that he makes a flop, he's got to go back to making, like, a Cockney, like, rip-off heist film.
Right.
Not to say there's anything wrong with that, though. I love, like, a good British crime film.
Oh, they're the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think... So this is kind of where we find how the tangled web, you know, gets every player that you were introduced to in 6 seconds involved.
Yeah.
So the stick-up guys are going to rob the posh kids for their wheat, where in turn our four boys are going to rob the stick-up kids.
Sure. Wow, this is like a Ghostface and Raekwon song.
Who are inadvertently robbing from a fairly higher-up Rory.
Yeah.
Who's also a sociopath. evidence in that scene, which is probably my favorite scene, where he's trying to watch the game at the bar, and some guy doesn't want to let him do it.
He throws a flaming Mo on him.
Yeah, exactly. I love the context of that scene is amazing, where he just, instead of, you know, reacting in any way, he just calmly walks the fire extinguisher outside of the bar. There's no fire extinguisher. He orders the highest proof alcohol in the bar. Gulps, spits it out all over this dude. Flicks a match into his bird's nest, which is Cockney for chest somehow, because it rhymes.
Uh huh.
And then the dude's on fire, and he has no fire extinguisher to get to him.
Yeah, rhyming slang. Love that. I'm gonna punch you in your Chevy Chase.
Right, that was a good one.
Sure.
I'm never surprised that people don't do Cockney accent. That American actors don't do Cockney accents. I haven't seen a single person try.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm probably wrong, but it's not an easy one to do.
Well, you texted me that YouTube Cockney accent video last night, and I watched it, but I haven't perfected it enough to, like, try. But I'm going to do my Cockney accent calisthenics.
Well, for an American, I mean, basically Cockney is you just throw phonics out of the fucking window. There's no rhyme or there's rhyme, but there's no reason to any of it. Yeah. You know, each sound changes, you know.
The glottal stop.
Bother becomes bava.
Whatever.
And then that th will sound different in the same sentence.
Yeah.
So there's just, yeah.
So
tough one to do.
All that's happening. So the movie's got this lock, stock, and two smoking barrels, and the barrels come into play here too, because our boys, the four that we're following, the youngest lads. Who are going to rob the stick-up kids, they need guns.
Mm-hmm.
So they ask Nick the Greek, who is another fun criminal
right.
mastermind in this to go find them some weapons.
He's more bumbling. He's like Benny Hill to me.
And they buy two old muskets off of him, antique shotguns rather, that he bought. Nick the Greek bought those from the two northern dudes.
Petty criminals. All just a whole litany of petty criminals versus a couple of underbosses.
Sure.
Right.
These two idiots.
These
that
two
look
idiots.
Like Simpsons characters.
They do. Otto.
And they had gotten those guns from robbing a lord, a governor.
Yeah.
In his mansion earlier. And now they're in trouble because they have to get these two guns back to give to Hatchet Harry. Because if they don't find these two antique guns, Hatchet Harry is going to kill them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So everyone's in the mix. Mm-hmm. It's like a bouillabaisse, a petty criminal bouillabaisse.
It is. It feels, I don't know what, I think Roger Ebert said that this film had like Marx Brothers humor in it. It is a comedy. It's a crime comedy.
It is.
And that I agree with him with that sort of like there's an anarchic, chaotic and destructive black humor to this.
Sure.
And it really is. We're setting up all the pieces here and it's become way overpopulated.
Yeah.
And in a couple minutes, it's everyone's going to kill each other.
Yeah. I will say that this is a very hard movie to review for that specific reason because we're trying our best here, but it's like there's so many moving parts and so many different characters.
Yeah.
So many different little twists to tie these people all together that it's just a difficult film to sort of navigate.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can talk a little bit about favorite scenes.
Yep.
And for me, I don't know. I mean, did you have anything specific that struck you as a scene that you really liked?
I mean, other than the, I liked this movie a whole lot. So I enjoyed watching every scene. The scene with Rory when he lights the guy on fire. Great. Great backdrop to show like what a calm sociopath looks like.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the two northerners robbing the Lord's mansion. I love that, you know, they show how sort of uncultured they are in the sense that they're like, these guys aren't rich. They can't even afford new furniture, even though all the furniture in there is antique and worth, you know, a ton of money. Other scenes I liked. I like everything with Vinnie Jones.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up. He's fantastic. He's like a breakout character in this.
Yes.
Actor. And I think this was one of his first movies, too. And then after this, he went on to be a heavy in multiple other films.
This was him and Statham's first roles. Yeah. He was released from police custody right before doing this film.
He's like the British Danny Trejo.
Yeah, kind of. He was a professional footballer.
Yeah.
And kind of a thug, like a thug on the field.
Yeah.
So he would, go for people's knees, necks, headbutts.
Sure, all the soft parts.
He was that guy, you know, just didn't give a shit. And it translates well into his, you know, persona in this film and probably his persona in general in real life. But he was awesome.
Yeah, he's such a bad dad, but also such a caring and tender dad.
He is. You know, he cares if the kid curses.
This movie's got a lot of bad dads in it. Mm. JD and Ed, and then also Big Chris and Little Chris.
Yep.
And Little Chris is adorable. Fucking hell.
Fucking hell.
He got a monkey in his wallet. Yeah. Or whatever he says. And he's like,
Language.
So, yeah. I loved everything with him in it, mm-hmm. including his last, the last scene where he brings a duffel bag to the boys.
Yep.
And he tells them that he lost his employer. And he ends his speech with, it's been emotional. Which is such a great stoic British gangster thing to say.
Yeah.
At the end of a long and stressful adventure.
That's true.
It's been emotional. Very understated.
That's sort of his, you know, everything he does is understated a little bit, except for the, you know, hyper violence when he smashes the head stick up guy's head in the car repeatedly. I didn't understand why he did that.
Oh, because he had put a knife to his son's neck.
Oh, that's why.
Yes.
That's right.
He's a good dad.
That's true.
Probably traumatized his son forever to see that dude's medulla oblongata hanging out of his neck.
Just 50 times.
Dripping into the gutter.
He slipped and smashed his head in that door.
Sure. If this film had been directed by Cronenberg, we would have seen all of that, a la History of Violence
right.
or Eastern Promises. But a lot of the violence in this movie happens right off screen.
It does.
So, you know, people do die, and they die in very slapstick ways. or brutal ways, but you don't really see a ton of blood.
No.
Including, you know, there is like the, I think another scene that I really liked was when the gang of stick-up kids get into the weed growers building, but they get stuck in the cage, and they have to negotiate for the weed growers to open the cage up.
Right.
And they torture them by, like, shooting their passed-out friend in the foot.
Yeah.
Which, again, was, I don't know, like, it could have been shot a lot gorier than it was. I think I would have woken up if I was passed out and somebody
shot your foot,
blew my toes off with a shotgun.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he continues to just lay there limp.
That's really good weed.
Yeah. Really good at playing possum.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. Because that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
Smart.
Well, some people have that reaction to less stressful situations.
Just narcolepsy? Yeah. Mild narcolepsy?
It's what is it? Fight?
Fight or flight?
Fight,
yeah.
Or nap?
Or nap. Fight, flight, or sleep.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I feel when somebody's like, you got a job interview coming up. I'm like, I'm going to take a nap.
Yeah.
Like, I don't run away. I don't fight it. Well, finally, you know, I'd say if they remade this movie in the U.S., I would have... Which I think they could do. They could make, like, an L.A. version of this movie.
Yeah, they did. It was called Pulp Fiction, but it wasn't, like, a remake. It was the predecessor.
Sure. But, you know, I would make it with, like, Flea as the dad.
Right.
Owning the bar.
You could do that. That makes a lot of sense. Now you could make it with Flea. He's old enough.
Yeah.
I thought the film was having trouble.
Go would be a more accurate take of this as kind of like an L.A. version.
That's true. Like a teen coming of age L.A., Lock Stock.
It had more of that music, what is it, like a music video vibe to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except in the 90s rave scene in L.A.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't thought about that movie in a while. That's
maybe that's something we can watch.
That's a good call. So the movie was having a lot of trouble finding American distribution. So Trudy Styler was sort of involved because her husband, Sting. She called an acquaintance of hers, Tom Cruise, who sat in at a screening.
Tom Cruise, most famous for his role in Vanilla Sky.
Mm-hmm. Definitely not.
Tom Cruise, friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. We like Tom Cruise here.
We reviewed so many things that he is connected to.
We respect his special brand of crazy.
Tom Cruise is our Kevin Bacon.
He freaked out, loved the movie, and you know, as soon as he walks in the room, people are like noticing that he's in the room, so other producers are coming in and watching it, and he said that this is the best movie I've seen in years. You guys would be fools not to buy it. So he really helped get the financing for this movie.
He's got that cosign power.
Yeah, I mean, this is 98, so this is, you know, Tom Cruise probably at, I would say, the height of his celebrity, the height of his power in Hollywood before he lost his mind on Oprah's couch.
Sure. Right now, at that point, he was the Dr. Manhattan of Hollywood.
Right. So that's how the movie came to be, with a tiny little budget.
Only the little engine they could.
Right. Grossed $140,000 in the U.S. opening weekend.
Wow.
U.S. gross was $3 million, a little over, almost $4 million. Not much, but again, a lot of great movies don't do well.
Yeah, but it had a lot of Guy Ritchie had a lot of social capital. You know,
he gained some cachet here.
Yeah, he married Madonna,
mm-hmm.
So he stole our Cleopatra away from us.
And gave her a British accent.
He had Tom Cruise bankrolling him, and this set the stage for him to make Snatch.
Yeah,
and you can just see Snatch is, it's a recombination of all of the same ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, you know, when I look at it, I'm like, oh, if it had been made by anybody else, I'd say this is derivative.
Oh yeah,
you know, but
it wouldn't have been allowed.
But it feels a lot like a the same film with a much bigger budget for production.
Yeah.
And for casting,
absolutely.
Yeah, so this was a great introduction to the world for Guy Ritchie, and I think honestly it holds up as like a unique and innovative movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely. People have copied in, you know, shots and pacing from him and cutscenes. The soundtrack itself was a thing of beauty. Perfectly done soundtrack. Might be the best one we've done.
Yeah.
You know, wall to wall. That's how he met Madonna, by the way. She
on music videos?
No, well, she saw the movie went nuts over the soundtrack, wanted to release the soundtrack under her label Maverick. So she got in contact with the guy that, you know, not composed the soundtrack, but put the soundtrack together, and Guy Ritchie. She was apparently interested in the other dude relationship-wise, but then they kind of hit it off.
Got it.
And that's how they...
He came in. He swooped in with his pickup artist techniques, right. His tactics. Nagged her a couple times, did some light Keno, and she was into it.
Yep. She's into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But and she had good ear for music because it was a great soundtrack, so she knew what she was doing.
And they spent a couple years together. They had a kid together.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple. Who knows?
Yeah.
Couple of kids.
All I know is Lourdes is not her. Not his.
That was a backup dancer, I think.
Sure. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Any Madonna fans out there, let us know.
Yeah, feel free to chime in on the Instagram page.
I listened to her first album recently.
What was her first album called?
I think it's called Madonna.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I'm sure.
I can tell why there's a reason she's a star.
Yeah, I grew up on her music.
So good.
Some great music.
Yeah, I went jogging. It's great jogging music.
Is it?
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Uh-huh. Star Bright. Burning.
Oh, that's
Yeah, that's bright. The one. That's the first album.
Well, thank you, Donna Ciccone. The Detroit product.
A great Italian-American hero.
Adopted New Yorker.
Let's see here. What did I want to say about this movie? Anything? Yeah, I love the camera work. I love the dialogue. I love how hyper-stylized it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you dance with the devil, you got to wait till the song finishes or something like that.
Sure. I don't think I've ever heard that before, but that's good.
That's something Hatchet Harry says.
Yeah. It was something like that.
Yeah.
It's your own take.
When you dance with the devil.
We're paraphrasing here.
Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Almost Joker in the alley.
Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight?
That's right.
But, you know, I think what he meant by that is you gotta wait until the deal is done.
Yep.
You know?
It's a don't count your chickens before they've hatched.
Sure.
Crime.
Yes. So, I love British crime movies. This made me want to go back and watch The Long Good Friday. I also love the British remake of Pusher. And also Get Carter.
Yeah.
And people compared this movie to, well, not a British crime movie, but another Gen X movie to come out from the UK around this time, which was Trainspotting.
Yep, and one of the same actors was in it.
Sure. Which one?
The guy, the skinnier friend that was initially involved with Nick the Greek, I believe, is in Trainspotting.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Oh, there are a couple Trainspotting people in this, I saw.
And this is the indie scene in Great Britain in the late 90s. You know, you're going to have a lot of the same actors.
And these movies both got compared a lot, I think, because they have that rock and roll soundtrack and that Gen X sensibility. Mm-hmm. But I think that they are – and they also are kind of like revolve around four men involved in petty crime.
Right.
But I think that they are like very, very different too. Because Trainspotting is more just about junkies.
It's about drugs, yeah.
And then
heroin specifically.
Yeah, and like it's
Scotland.
A coming of age movie around heroin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is not that. This is kind of like a pulp crime farce.
Right. With really good comedic undertones.
Yes. Yeah. So two very different movies, but I can see why people would compare them.
Another good one reference-wise, British semi-crime drama was Croupier, which came out around the same time, which had Clive Owen. I think that was his big debut. He played a croupier, which is a dealer at a casino.
Yeah, I need to check that one out again. I feel like it's a little bit more understated.
It is.
This has got all the adrenaline in it.
It does.
Yeah.
Croupier, not funny.
Somber.
Right.
All right. So here we go. I give the. What do you give this movie?
That's a good question. I wasn't ready, man.
Oh my God.
I mean, I give this movie, if you haven't, this is tough. It's just, it's an awesome movie. I loved it. So
I give this movie 7 antique shotguns out of 10 and 1 Samoan Joe, cocktail.
One Samoan Joe cocktail?
Yeah. So we'll say that's like half a shotgun.
You said so 7.
7.5.
Good. I'm going to go up on that one. I'll do 8.
Okay.
I'll do 8 just out of reach fire extinguishers.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, folks. Thank you, friends. Thank you, fellow countrymen. Thank you, all of our international listeners. Shout outs to anybody listening to us in Australia. Also, if you're in Hong Kong right now listening, what up? thank you for your continuing support. And we are Eat, Pray, Judge, and we will be back next week with another film and another guest. And we're still pondering what October Halloween spooky, spooktacular horror movie to cover. So if you want to, you can slide in our DMs on our Instagram or our Twitter and let us know if you have any suggestions.
We're taking requests, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
We love you. Peace. Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me?